This is part one of a two-parter with Martin Beebe. In this part, we cover how AWS supports .NET. This is a No Double podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Martin Beebe, who's joining me very, very late at night his time. Thank you very much for taking time out of your morning or night, as you see it.
It's no problem at all. It's quite good fun to be up at this early hour for me.
It's 12:45 your time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. AM, yeah. And I actually, I've snuck out to my office, and my wife had already fallen asleep, so she doesn't actually know where I am at the moment. So I'm hoping she doesn't freak out if she wakes up. Yeah.
So start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
So my name is Martin Beebe, and I'm a developer advocate at AWS. I'm a lifelong C# developer, .NET developer, VB developer, ASP.NET, ASP developer. I've been developing for about 20 years, and I work at AWS talking about .NET on AWS.
I don't often admit the VB part, but I have done VB.NET for about 2 years.
No, I'm a big fan of mentioning the VB.NET part of things, because it was a big thing for me. I came from ASP, so I was really familiar with VB script and then VB, and then VB.NET. I worked on a big project called Einstein, which was my very first large project. And I was large because I was the only person working on it. And it was mammoth in terms of this company. It's a US company called Systemax. And so they used to own an IT reseller called tiger.com. And I wrote this whole business intelligence system in VB.NET, and it was a big thing for me. And then I got offered a C# job by the web front end people, by the web people. And I was really excited about it. And they said, oh, you do .NET? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Well, all of our stuff's in C#. You know C#, don't you? And I was like, oh, yeah, I know C#. No problem. I didn't know C#. And I basically spent my first 2 months of that job transpiling VB.NET code to C# using the online Telerik converter. And so I would basically write my code in VB and then translate it into C#, and then get it working in C#, because it wasn't that great, the compiler. And then I would figure it out. So that was basically how I spent most of 2006, which was trying to learn C# through VB. So I'm very proud of those roots.
I actually went the other way. I started with C# with .NET 1.1 and 2. And then when I moved to the US, I went to VB.NET, it took me a few months to get used to it. And then when I moved back to C#, it took me a couple of days to get back to C#.
I think the problem actually in that is that there was this massive context shift between the way that you wrote those sorts of applications. So, but I would like on a daily basis be working with the two of them. And I find that same problem of context switching when I work with JavaScript and .NET is that if I work on one too much, then I can't go instantly back to the other one without making some really, basic errors. And there's a soft spot in my heart for VB. I don't care what anyone says. And we have lots of customers still which come up to me these days saying we've got large VB.NET applications, or they're VB developers. So I'm always keen not to, belittle it in any way. It's still there. It still happens.
What do you do as a developer advocate at AWS?
Largely speaking, events. So that's the main 80% of my job is going to events, speaking on stage, talking about different things that we've got. The other part of my job is I write on the AWS news blog. So it's sometimes called colloquially as the Jeff's blog, because Jeff Barr originally founded that blog 15 years ago. And to be basically every service release that AWS has, that we write a blog post about it. And that blog post has to be not just descriptive, it also has to have a tutorial in it. So I'm of a team of about 4 or 5 people in that team, which write. There's a bigger team actually than that, but there's a core sort of writers of about 5 to 10, depending on the time of year, who write for that. And we're currently writing tons and tons of blog posts at the moment, because we have our reInvent conference at the end of in December. And so that's where basically we launch most of our products, or we have most of our feature launches. So that's most of my time at the moment. So it's blogging, it's speaking at events, then it's doing, online broadcasts now an awful lot more, doing Twitch and that sort of thing. But So that's the actual like physical activity that I do. And then the other side of my job that no one really sees is that when you're at an event and a customer tells you something about, you know, that they don't like our docs, or they don't like our SDK, or they don't like our API, or they don't like the way that our product works, I'm the one which would try and feed that back to our product teams to try and get that fixed. We have like formal routes for that and really informal ones, but managing that process of making sure that customer feedback gets back to our product teams. I would say that's most of my job. There's probably other things on my job description that I'm not including there, but that's roughly what I do.
Do you ever get the question, you know, is AWS for .NET developers?
Yeah, I mean, I get that every day, obviously, because I am going to sort of .NET conferences and .NET events generally, where perhaps most of the audience don't really use AWS or aren't familiar with AWS. It's common. I think the perception is that amongst people which don't use AWS is that AWS isn't for .NET developers. They have a perception that that's the case. But of course, I see it from the other side, which is we have lots of customers who are using .NET and using AWS. So there's like a perception thing. And then the reality is that we have lots of big customers using AWS with .NET. And for the large part, you can do everything you need to do as a .NET developer on AWS. You can build any kind of application that you want. And the other advantage is that we have really great resiliency, really great capacity, and really great scale. So there's a lot of reasons why you would choose AWS as a .NET developer. And it's certainly a very productive place to be if you're a .NET developer.
What about, a natural feel that Azure is more aligned with C#, with .NET? Is AWS attempting to provide that, or is it more, well, look, AWS is across multiple languages, do whatever you want?
I think as a cloud provider, we have to support customers and their demands, are not just one language. So, you know, we have to support all the different languages out there. So there's very rarely a customer now which is completely and purely a one language shop. So there's very few which are just Java or just Go or just Node or just C# anymore. I think there's a lot more mix in there. And so you'll have certain projects which are in C# and you'll have certain projects which are in Java. And so any cloud provider which is trying to provide a service to any kind of customers has to have good support across all of the languages. You can't focus on a specific one. What we're trying to do is make sure that AWS is the best place for .NET developers. So the best and most innovative place for .NET developers. That's kind of what I strive to aim for. And when we're releasing any services, I'm always asking questions like, is this the best that this can be? Is this the easiest that it can be? Is this the best service that we could give .NET developers? And, of course, there's times when we'll get that wrong. But I like to think that we really try and put the customer first and think about what they want. And I think AWS as it stands provides a really compelling platform for .NET devs.
I suppose you could say with Microsoft having moved to both open source and cross platform, it's become very, very easy to develop in pretty much any hardware, any operating system, and then deploy the same. So like, you know, I probably half my development work in .NET on Linux and Ubuntu using VS Code rather than on Windows. Whereas a few years ago, I was wedded to my Windows and my Visual Studio 2017 or 2019 or whatever it was.
Yeah. Well, I'm very similar. I left Microsoft in 2017 and I'd been there for 8 years. And so I made a very specific choice to like see what the other side of the world is like. So I abandoned everything which was Microsoft just purely to try different things out now that I had the opportunity. And so I was a long-term Windows user and I reluctantly went to use a Mac, and I started delving much more into Linux. I did a lot more Java at that time in 2017 because of the employer that I worked for, and Go and Node. I'd done actually weirdly, or maybe not weirdly, I'd done an awful lot of Node development and TypeScript development when I was at Microsoft. So I've always kind of liked to dabble in different languages, but I very much sort of went away from .NET for a period there. And then I got a call in sort of 2018, end of 2018. So I've been away from it for about 2 years, from my former boss at AWS called Ian Massingham, who said, I remember you speaking about .NET. I've seen you speaking about .NET before. And we're looking for someone at AWS which can bring a .NET perspective to AWS. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. I'll have a think about it, because I'd kind of moved away a little bit. And then I started like playing with .NET again. And I don't know, I've really started to grow and love it again. And I really got this sort of feel for .NET again. And sometimes it felt like coming home. But I must admit, I've brought some of those things from those other languages with me. So I still use a Mac predominantly. I use Rider, JetBrains Rider, as my general IDE. And I'm much more focused on building .NET Core applications for Linux than I am for Windows. So, and yeah, I feel like I've grown a little bit and then came back into the fold, into the .NET fold a little bit. And I feel like I'm a stronger developer for it, to be honest with you. I think I've got a better understanding than what I had previously. And I can do more things in more interesting and different ways. Although I would say that sometimes it can be really frustrating being on a Mac on Rider and not like getting the absolute latest update for, you know, the .NET framework or the absolute latest thing from C#, which is included in VS Visual Studio. So occasionally I still have a Windows box that I use for streaming and for Visual Studio. And I'll often go back into that and have a look at what's in that world, because Visual Studio is still one of the best IDEs out there, no doubt. But it is quite nice sometimes to just take a break from it. So yeah.
No, I agree with you on a few of those points as well. I'm doing more Node development now, and I'm mostly enjoying it. And there are definitely times when I'm using it, it's sort of, oh, this is far easier to do something in than it is in C#. But then I'll come across something that is way easier to do it in C#. And you kind of go back and forth between the two. And yes, on Visual Studio 2019, wonderful. But at the same time, I really like VS Code because it's so fast, and I tend to have 5 or 6 of them open. And also I'm doing my Terraform in my VS Code. I'm doing my Node in it. I'm doing my C#. You know, I'm working on a markdown file for a blog post. I have all of those going at the same time.
Yeah, I think the actual biggest thing, I didn't even mention it there, but the biggest change for me was I adopted Docker. I started using Docker and different container platforms like Kubernetes, and I don't really use that very much at the moment. But but Docker started becoming a big part of my developer workflow, and it wasn't. That just wasn't when I was using Visual Studio, and I still feel like in Visual Studio the Docker workflow isn't quite, you know, it's not. I don't know. Maybe I'm using it wrong, but it doesn't feel like that's the way that most people do it. Whereas I find that the only way I can really be productive in the current world that I live in with Rider and stuff is to really fully embrace Docker. And I used that outside of .NET a lot, learned Docker without talking about .NET. And then when I came back to .NET, I was like, well, how do I make sure that I can start using Docker, and how do I get that built into the sort of the workflow that I produce stuff?
I haven't used Docker for a little while on Windows. I'm using it on Linux and on Mac, but I find it much easier and faster to work with on Linux or on the Mac than on my Windows. Even though my Windows is a pretty powerful year and a half old computer, my 8-year-old Linux runs Docker far more smoothly for me.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think that one of the things that I really like, though, is the, and this is the truth of both, I think this comes from my Windows days, I do like a UI. I'm quite a big fan of a UI. And I like the way that, I think it was on Windows first, the Kitematic support inside of Docker for Windows and stuff. So I think that, I've never really had any problems with Docker on Windows. I've even experimented with Windows Docker containers. And the only problem really is that they're massive. and you end up with huge containers, but it's still fundamentally the same sort of thing. I haven't noticed necessarily that it's like more flaky or whatever, but the that UI experience, and you get that on both Mac now and obviously on Windows, but I felt and it might not have been the case, but it felt for me at least that was better for a time on Windows.
To be fair, it was a corporate laptop that had a lot of security software on it, which may have been interfering, but we digress. So let me bring us back to our our topic. So for as a .NET developer, would you say, I know you said AWS is multi-language, would you say though that C#.NET is a first-class citizen for AWS?
Yes, and it's very much so. We invest a lot of money to try and make sure that our tooling is good and that it feels comfortable for people. But I'm not going to pretend that it's going to feel exactly the same for you as a .NET developer. In fact, look, when I came to AWS, it felt very alien to me. I'll tell you honestly, I didn't really understand a lot of the concepts which underpin AWS. And that isn't really a .NET thing necessarily. It's much more of an AWS thing. There is a certain way that AWS operates and works, and it doesn't really matter what language you use. That's the kind of the way that it works. And I think there's no point hiding that. Like the AWS team, the .NET team which work on AWS don't hide any of that AWS-ness about AWS. And I think that's the biggest hurdle for most .NET developers, is that things are called different names than what people might be used to in other cloud platforms like Azure. There's some things which are called the same thing, but they're actually very, very different, which is actually probably a worse problem, where you have like naming conventions where things that they've got the exact same meaning or name, but when you actually come to use them, you realize, oh my God, they're actually very different beasts. These are completely different things. But our goal and the team I work in, and then there's a greater .NET team at AWS in the US. Their goal is to try and make it feel comfortable for a .NET developer, make it easy. So we have things like .NET SDKs. We have, in fact, the .NET SDK, the C# SDK for AWS was the first SDK that AWS ever released. So I can't remember the year now, but it's probably nearly 10 years on. But we didn't have a unified SDK across any of our platform until we released the .NET version. And we have tooling support for things like Visual Studio. So we have like a plugin which allows you to do certain things. We have plugins for JetBrains Rider, for VS Code, and not just .NET as well. We have quite good support for PowerShell across our platform as well. So most of the automation things can be done through PowerShell as well. So depending on the audience I speak to, whether they be .NET developers or Windows developers, which might be using Windows IT professionals, which might be using things like PowerShell, we have really good support for those things. But it's not, obviously we didn't write C#, and we don't write .NET. So there are times when, you might not feel as familiar with as a .NET developer sometimes in the AWS ecosystem, because a lot of the announcements which are being made about services generally, they're not just about .NET or about the newest features of C#. But I feel very comfortable in AWS as a C# developer, and AWS, the product teams are very good at making sure that we have like very quick support for things like, when 3.1 came out, and it had an LTS release, we made sure that we had that in Lambda, for example. So as things get released from the .NET and C# side, we make sure that we have support. When 2000 Visual Studio 2019 was released, we made sure that our AWS toolkit was released on the same day as that. I think it was the same day or the day after of that release. So yeah, we work really hard to try and make sure that people feel comfortable. Sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong. And I guess it's my job to try and, when we do get it wrong and customers tell me that we've got it wrong, to try and feed that back to our product teams to try and improve it.
I have found I was using C# to work with Dynamo Tables. And I found, I think, as you said, a kind of a an uneasiness using it. It didn't feel like it worked the way I felt it should work. And I found the same thing with the documentation. So for me, that was, it wasn't a struggle, but what I kind of, I suppose what the problem was, I didn't know if I was doing it right. So there was an example, I was trying to do some Dynamo read and writes inside a .NET API controller. I didn't know what pattern to follow for injecting the Dynamo context or whatever the name of it is. I can't quite remember. I didn't know whether I should do it as a singleton or whether I should do it on a request scope. I found the documentation absent of that kind of thing. So I had to make a best guess. Now, if you do that wrong with Entity Framework, you have some pretty serious problems. And I that's where I felt that I... It wasn't hard to do it, but I didn't know if it was good, and I don't know whether it was production quality.
Yeah, I think with DynamoDB, for example, that's a good example of a service where there are lots of abstractions on top of it as well. Like if you just look at the very basic ways to implement or work with DynamoDB, you end up writing a lot of C# code. Like you end up, because you know, you actually end up writing the writes, and it can be really convoluted. But there are, like in the SDK, there are wrappers around some of that. But you're quite right. I think this is always the thing. This is the problem with these sorts of things. Like I often see the problems with documentation too, and I feed that back as much as possible. But it is really hard when you have 165 different services, making sure that you have not just documentation which describes how fundamentally it works, but then also how it would practically work in production, or you know, the hints and tips to make it perform better or to follow certain patterns or those things. I admit that I think we could do a better job of making sure that we have not just the functional ways that it works, but maybe best practices of it. And we do that in certain aspects of our documentation, but I probably agree that we don't do it well enough sometimes in C#.
Another scenario I came across, I had to write a Lambda, and I was reading about performance and startup times and all that sort of stuff, and I decided to write it in Node. But as we were prepping for this conversation, you were saying, no, there isn't a massive difference between C# and Node for Lambdas. Can you talk about that?
Well, it depends. There are differences based upon, obviously, one's a managed language and one isn't. And so there's advantages to that being an unmanaged language when you're in Lambda. And I don't want to go into the internals because, frankly, I'm not a Lambda expert of the Lambda internals, but... there's certainly been third-party publications which show that whilst .NET might not be the fastest framework in terms of startup time, when it actually is operating, it's one of the fastest runtimes that we have. And we do an awful lot of work at AWS to making sure that all of the supported runtimes are fast and work they meet our criteria for performance. So, we have lots of different languages which are supported. There's you know, the major one, C# has been a major supported language for a long time now. But we also support things like custom runtimes as well. So people have written third-party providers for things like PHP and stuff like that. So you could write a COBOL Lambda if you wanted to, and you had enough time to, I think someone actually has already really written that custom runtime provider. But generally the providers that we provide, you know, they meet a certain criteria in terms of their performance. And there are differences around things like cold start times, which means that when a Lambda hasn't been executed already, different languages have different performance characteristics. But in terms of operating them and using them, you know, we have some huge customers which use Lambda in .NET to run production systems. It's not an experiment or an idea that we've got customers who've been using this for many, many years in production at large scale. But there are, of course, there are differences between different languages. But if I was a .NET person, there's no way that I would necessarily learn Node from a performance point of view just to be able to do Lambda. There are reasons, however, in Lambda to choose Node. And that would be, I did this a lot, actually. When .NET Core first came out, it didn't have very good ways of manipulating images. Like there was no systems dot the system dot imaging sort of, I can't even remember what the namespace is in .NET's called, but the system, like working with images in .NET, that was not included in .NET Core. So I was finding I had quite a lot of jobs that I needed to do with image manipulation. So I wrote those lambdas in Node, but I still wrote some of the core, some of them in C#. So I always had like a mixed infrastructure. Similarly, when I wanted to work with audio, in .NET, the libraries for audio are either not very good or very expensive. So I just wanted to do, I think it was just normalization. I wanted to detect when there was silence in a piece of audio. And to do that in C#, it was, I couldn't find a library which didn't cost money. And I didn't have any money for this particular project that I was working on. And so I wrote that one in Python, because I could find really simply a Python example which did it. I think that's one of the powers of something like Lambda, is that you actually can write applications which span multiple Lambda functions and are potentially written in different languages, not necessarily for performance, but much more for the capabilities of that language, because there are certain things that certain languages just do better. Audio in Python is just easier. Dealing with certain APIs, it's just easier in C#. And Node was really good for images, actually, using .NET Core. I can do the same thing in .NET Core nowadays. But that's the reason I generally don't use different languages in Lambda. It's not for performance reasons, really. In fact, one of the common performance issues that people used to have with Lambda is that they would call or create a SQL connection inside of a Lambda function. And that would, because of the way that the networking infrastructure in Lambda works, that could create this sort of latency problem where you would have this connection on every time that someone called the Lambda function, you would have this database connection spun up, and it would take a long time to actually to establish that connection. And in C#, in up using connecting to a SQL database, that used to be a bit of a problem. But of course, you know, there's ways around that, and now there's that problem is largely solved because of the architecture of Lambda's changed somewhat. But there are always these caveats and problems and certain things and places where you can cause problems. For example, in .NET, I'm very used to optimizing for like loading stuff into memory. If you do that in a Lambda function, that's a really bad idea. Like inversion of control, or adding in some libraries which do inversion of control, they often use a lot of memory up front because they know over a long period of time they're going to benefit from that stuff being in memory. But a Lambda function might only be operating for 10 seconds. And so if you've loaded stuff, loads of stuff into memory and then not used any of that memory, that was a complete waste of time and computation and things. So I would say that most of the time around performance, it's not usually the runtime which is the big performance problem. It's usually the way that you write code and the sorts of things that might trip you up inside of a Lambda function.
That's good to know. Yeah, so I did it for processing data coming in on Kinesis and moving it to Elasticsearch in bulk inserts. And there were some good examples in Node, which was part of what helped me with it. But also, you know, it was part of my, I want to learn some Node along the way.
I've written that exact same integration using PowerShell, because we have PowerShell support in Lambda functions as well. Although now you wouldn't necessarily even need to Kinesis into Elasticsearch. I think could you not like now use potentially use EventBridge for that? I don't know actually.
Haven't heard of EventBridge.
If you're an AWS newbie as well, one of the things that's going to definitely cause you problems is just you will be overwhelmed by the number of services. And I am a paid up employee of AWS, and I still haven't tried all of the different services. And I think a lot of people come to AWS and they look at all the different things and think, oh gosh, there's a lot here. And then that can be quite off-putting. You know, it's a cool thing to sort of brag about. Oh, we've got over 165 different services, or you can do this, you can do that, you can do quantum computing, you can do serverless, you can do eight different types of database. There's all of these different features and functions. But for someone which is brand new to it, it can be really overwhelming. And a lot of the time, you only really need to know the core services in AWS, and But there's cases where you'll find that there's actually a service which exists, which does something which you might not have heard of, which could make your life easier. And I discover that all the time. And I think that's one thing which I hope that advocates can AWS can help with, is to help explain different services and show people new things that they might not have thought of before. But it's always a constant problem, is that a customer will tell me that they're trying to do something, and you're like, oh, did you not know that we've got this service over here which can do that? So, for example, I was working with a customer recently who were trying to build a video player, and then they were doing live stream video to this white label video player that they'd created, and then they wanted to have interactive elements like polls come up when they were working with the video. And we've just released a service called Interactive Video Service, which basically enables you to do that. So you're able to just, you know, have a stream to this particular endpoint, and it will play out over a video player. And then we've got a whole API which allows you to ingest like events into the video stream, which invoke things that can happen inside of the client application. So like we packaged that up as an entire service. And this customer were off here on the left, building this whole thing, not realizing that we had that service. And that's a massive failure in my job, I think, sometimes, is that I'm not communicating. I feel like we're letting our customers down when I see things like that, because you're like, oh, I wish you knew that we had this particular service. So there are lots of services like that, and lots of things in AWS, which you might not have heard of, which could make your life easier, or, you know, a place where we've already solved the problem. In the .NET world, the most common one is that we see, I see, is that people will put SQL servers on EC2 instances. And then the question they'll come up with, we say something like, how do I do high availability SQL server? Like, how do I do high availability with SQL server on EC2 instances? And we can explain how you do that and stuff, but we do have a service called RDS, the Relational Database Service for SQL Server, which is basically allows you to do high availability as a service, and you just have to tick a box, and high availability SQL servers are available to you as a service, a managed service. And I've spoke to lots of people which don't realize that we have that service, and so they're trying to roll it themselves. It's a common problem.
And that's Microsoft SQL Server as opposed to Postgres or MySQL or Aurora?
So we have RDS for different database engines. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the Relational Database Service for Microsoft SQL Server, or the Relational Database Service for Postgres. The concept is the same. RDS is the service, and then you choose your database engine, which sits underneath that. And obviously, then once we manage this database for you, it's then a case of connecting to that database, and then you use it. It actually, RDS for Microsoft SQL Server, under the hood, under the cover, we're just running. We are actually running Windows servers. We're running, you know, proper Microsoft SQL Server. It's not a different version of it. It's not a AWS version of SQL Server. It's SQL Server that we're running. And then when you tick the high availability button or checkbox when you're creating your RDS instance, we're doing exactly everything that a regular DBA would have to have ordinarily done. We've just made that as a service, or managed it as a service, and then we manage that whole that piece of infrastructure for you. So we make sure that you can scale it, or you can, if it fails, we'll replace nodes and those sorts of things. It becomes like a managed service, a database service for you. If you don't know it exists, then you don't know it's there, and so you don't use it. And I think that's always a challenge when you've got so many services, to make sure customers are aware of all the different things. And I guess that's why they employ advocates and people like me to try and explain or communicate that to customers.
That's the end of part one. In part two, we cover security, more security, documentation, .NET tooling, infrastructure as code, and how to get started on AWS. If you liked this episode, you might also like episode 150 with Luke Hoban of Pulumi about infrastructure as software, episode 132 with Lars Klint about cloud first, or episode 111 with Michael Dowden about serverless computing. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Pictures of the Floating World by Cloud Chamber.